Muhammad, Disc 6.
Mutiny was in the air. The fragile solidarity that had united the pilgrims throughout this dangerous expedition was shattered, and the deep rifts that had always existed within the Ummah became suddenly apparent. Omar leapt to his feet and strode over to Abu Bakr. "Are we not Muslims and they polytheists?" he demanded. "Why should we agree to what is demeaning to our religion?" Abu Bakr was also disturbed, but managed to reply that, in spite of everything, he still had faith in the Prophet. Later, Omar said that if he could have found 100 companions to follow him, he would have defected. At this point, he could not share Muhammad's vision. Like many of the Medinese Muslims and those emigrants who came from the more peripheral, disadvantaged Quraishan clans, he did not want merely to reform the social order of Mecca, but to overthrow it and replace it with a purely Quranic regime. Omar was courageous, unselfish, and passionately committed to the ideals of justice and equity, which had been so lacking in the Meccan polity. But he was not a man of hilm, of forbearance, and was still fired by the fierce impetuosity of Jahiliyyah. He did not understand that the values of gentleness and non-violence were also central to the Islamic ideal. He was a man of action, prone to reach, Jahili-like, for his sword without thinking matters through. Faced with Muhammad's apparent about-face at Hudaybiyah, he was bewildered and confused. After defeating the Quraysh at the Battle of the Trench, the obvious plan would have been to press on and destroy them unilaterally. But this had never been Muhammad's intention. The downfall of Mecca would be an inconceivable catastrophe for Arabia, a backward region that sorely needed the commercial genius of the Quraysh, who would never see the point of Islam while the war continued to fuel destructive anger and hatred on both sides. By abandoning the economic blockade, Muhammad hoped to win them over. He could see further than anybody else at Hudaybiyah. Far from caving in weakly, he knew exactly what he was doing. He was moving toward an unprecedented political and religious solution for the Arabs, and that meant that he could never do the expected thing, because that would bind him to the unhappy status quo. When he looked at the stunned, miserable faces of the pilgrims, Muhammad had to tell them that they must accept the terms of the treaty because Allah had dictated them. This did not satisfy the rank and file, who had expected some kind of miracle, and it was intensely disappointing to the hypocrites, who had joined the Ummah simply for worldly gain. The atmosphere became even more strained when the Muslims heard the wording of the treaty. Muhammad summoned Ali to write to his dictation, and when he began with the usual Muslim formula, "In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful," Suhail found these attributes of Allah somewhat feeble, so he insisted that Muhammad begin with the more conventional formula, "In thy name, O Allah." To the horror of the Muslims, Muhammad agreed without demur. Worse was to follow. Muhammad continued, "This is the treaty that Muhammad, the messenger of Allah, has agreed with Suhail ibn Amr." Again, Suhail interrupted. If he had believed that Muhammad was God's prophet, he argued reasonably enough, he would not have fought him all these years. He asked Muhammad simply to use his own name and that of his father in the usual way. Ali had already written down the words, "the messenger of God," and told Muhammad that he simply could not bring himself to excise them. So the prophet held out his hand for the pen, asked Ali to point to the words on the parchment, and crossed them out himself. He continued, "This is what Muhammad ibn Abdullah has agreed with Suhail ibn Amr." At this extremely difficult juncture, just as the treaty was being signed, Suhail's son Abu Jandal burst onto the scene. He had converted to Islam, but Suhail had locked him up in the family home in order to prevent him making the Hijra to Medina. Now, however, he had managed to escape and arrived triumphantly to join the Muslims at Hudaybiyah, dragging his fetters behind him. Suhail smashed his fist into his son's face, grabbed his chains, and turned to Muhammad. Would he keep his word and return this renegade to his lawful guardian? Muhammad did not falter. Even though Abu Jandal screamed in anguish as Suhail dragged him back to Mecca, "Am I to be returned to the polytheists that they may entice me from my religion, O Muslims?" With classic understatement, Ibn Ishaq remarks, "That increased the people's dejection." This was the last straw for Umar. Yet again, he jumped to his feet and yelled at the man he had followed so loyally for 12 years. Was he not God's messenger? Were not the Muslims right and their enemies wrong? Had not Muhammad assured them that they would pray again at the Kaaba? This was all true, Muhammad replied mildly, but had he promised that they would return to the Haram this year? Umar remained grimly silent, so Muhammad continued firmly, "I am God's messenger. I will not go against his commandments, and he will not make me the loser." Even though he was bitterly perplexed, Umar subsided and reluctantly put his hand to the treaty. But the pilgrims were still furious, and there was a dangerous moment when they seemed about to rebel. Muhammad announced that even though they had not reached the Kaaba, they would complete the pilgrimage right there at Hudaybiyah. The Muslims must shave their heads and sacrifice their camels, just as they would if they were in the heart of Mecca. There was absolute silence, and the pilgrims stared grimly back at Muhammad, tacitly refusing to obey. In despair, the Prophet retreated to his tent. "What on earth could he do?" he asked Salama. She judged the situation perfectly. Muhammad should go out and, without uttering another word, sacrifice the camel that he had consecrated to Allah. It was exactly the right decision. The spectacular bloodletting broke through the torpor of depression, and immediately the men fell over themselves to sacrifice their own camels and shaved each other's heads with such zeal that Salama said later that she thought they would inflict mortal wounds in their pious frenzy. The pilgrims started home in a lighter mood, but some anger remained, and the Prophet himself seemed distant and preoccupied. Umar was afraid that his defiance had irreparably damaged their friendship, and his heart sank when he was summoned to join Muhammad at the head of the party. But, to his intense relief, he found him looking radiant, as though a great weight had fallen from his shoulders. "A surah has descended upon me, which is dearer to me than anything under the sun," he told Umar. This was Al-Fatah, the surah of victory. It laid bare the deeper meaning of the events at Hudaybiyah and began with a luminous assurance that Muhammad had not suffered a diplomatic defeat there, but that God had given him a manifest victory. He had sent down his Sakina, the spirit of peace and tranquility, which had entered the hearts of the Muslims. They had made a courageous act of faith when they agreed to accompany Muhammad on this perilous expedition, showing a commitment that had been beyond the Bedouin. They had shown their faith and trust again when they had sworn the oath of good pleasure. Finally, the treaty that Muhammad had made with Mecca was a sign, an ayah, a parable, which revealed God's presence. The victory at Hudaybiyah had distinguished the Muslims from the Quraysh, who had shown throughout the day that they were still in thrall to the overbearing haughtiness and intransigence of the Jahiliyyah, a stubborn resistance to anything that might injure their sense of honour or their traditional way of life. They had even been ready to massacre the innocent unarmed pilgrims rather than accept the humiliation of admitting them to the Haram. When, in the hearts of those who persist in unbelief, arose the characteristic arrogance, the arrogance of Jahiliyyah, says the Quran, then God sent down his peace of soul upon his messenger and upon the believers, and imposed upon them the formula of self-restraint, of hilm, for that was most befitting to them, and they were most suited for that. Muslims were not supposed to be men of war. They were characterized by the spirit of hilm, a peace and forbearance that allied them with the Jews and Christians, the people of the book. Instead of posturing aggressively as the Quraysh had done at Hudaybiyah, the true followers of Allah prostrated themselves humbly before God in prayer. Thou seest them, the Quran concluded, bowing, prostrating, seeking bounty from God and good pleasure. Their mark is on their faces, the trace of prostration. That is their likeness in the Torah and their likeness in the Gospel. It was not violence and self-assertion, but the spirit of mercy, courtesy, and tranquility that would cause the Ummah to grow as a seed that puts forth its shoot and strengthens it, and it grows stout and raises straight upon its stalk, pleasing the owners. The war was over. It was now time for a holy peace. In fact, the struggle would continue. But the sources agree that Hudaybiyah was a watershed. No previous victory, Fatah, was greater than this, Ibn Ishaq believed. The root meaning of Fatah was opening. The truce had looked unpromising at first, but it opened new doors for Islam. Hitherto, nobody had been able to sit down and discuss the new religion in a rational manner because of the constant fighting and escalating hatred. But now, when there was an armistice and men met in safety and consulted together, none talked about Islam intelligently without entering it, said Ibn Ishaq. Indeed, between 628 and 630, double as many, or more than double as many, entered Islam as ever before. The short, lyrical surah An-Nasr, Help, may have been composed at this time. When the help of God arrived, and the opening, the Fatah, and you saw people joining the religion of God in waves, recite the praise of your Lord and say, God forgive. He is the always forgiving. There was to be no triumphalism, no cry for vengeance. The new era must be characterized by gratitude, forgiveness, and an acknowledgement of the Muslim's own culpability. Hudaybiyah may have improved the position of Islam in the peninsula as a whole, but, like other recent advances, it did little for Muhammad's standing in Medina. Many of the pilgrims, helpers and emigrants alike, continued to feel cheated and resentful. How, the emigrants asked, were they supposed to earn a living if they could no longer attack the Meccan caravans? Muhammad knew that he could not allow this discontent to fester. Somehow, he had to find a way of compensating them without damaging the truce. So, after Hudaybiyah, he directed the Muslims' attention to the north, away from Mecca. Kaaba, the new home of the exiled Jewish tribe of Nadir, was still a danger. The leaders of the settlement continued to stir up hostility to Muhammad among the northern tribes. So, shortly after his return from Hudaybiyah, he set off to besiege the city with an army of 600 men. When the Quraysh heard the news, they were jubilant, certain that the Muslims would be defeated. Surrounded, like Medina, with plains of volcanic rock and defended by seven large fortresses, Kaaba was thought to be impregnable. But the Muslims were able to benefit from the internal strife that signalled the decline of the tribal spirit in Kaaba as it had in Medina. Each of the tribes in Kaaba was autonomous, and they found it impossible to cooperate effectively during the siege. To add to their troubles, the tribes of Ghatafan, whose support they had been expecting, failed to show up, So, after a month, the Jewish elders asked for peace and became vassals of Medina. To seal the agreement, Muhammad took the daughter of his old enemy, Huyai, chief of Nadir, as his wife. The beautiful 17-year-old Safiya was happy to enter Islam, and Muhammad gave stern orders that there were to be no unkind remarks about her father, who had died during the siege. He told Safiya that if any of his other wives taunted her about her Jewish ancestry, she should reply, "My father is Aaron and my uncle is Moses." The marriage expressed the attitude of reconciliation and forgiveness that he was trying to promote. It was time to lay aside the hatred and bloodshed of the past. On his return from Khaybar, Muhammad enjoyed a joyful family reunion. After Hudaybiyah, he had sent a message to the Muslim exiles still resident in Abyssinia, inviting them to return now that the situation in Arabia had improved. And when he returned home, his cousin Ja'far, Abu Talib's son, whom he had not seen for 13 years, was waiting for him in Medina. He also greeted yet another new wife. Earlier that year, he had learned that his cousin, Ubaidullah ibn Jash, had died in Abyssinia and decided to marry his wife Ramla, usually known as Habiba. The ceremony was performed by proxy before the Negus, and an apartment had already been prepared for her in the mosque. This was another shrewd political move, because Habiba was the daughter of Abu Sufyan. The rest of the year was spent in routine raiding, some of which was undertaken at the request of his new Jewish allies in the north. Then, in March 629, the month of the Hajj, it was time for Muhammad to lead another pilgrimage to the Kaaba. This time, 2,600 pilgrims accompanied him, and as they approached the sanctuary, the Quraysh evacuated the city, as they had agreed. The Quraysh elders watched the arrival of Muhammad from the top of a nearby mountain. The sound of the Muslims loudly announcing their presence with the traditional cry, "Here I am, O Allah, here I am," must have echoed through the valleys and empty streets of the city like a cruel taunt. But they must also have been impressed by the discipline of the Muslims. There were no scenes of unbridled joy or unseemly celebrations, no jeering at the Quraysh. Instead, the huge crowd of pilgrims filed slowly and solemnly into the city, led by Muhammad, who, as usual, was mounted on his camel Kaswa. When he reached the Kaaba, he dismounted and kissed the black stone, embracing it, and then proceeded to make the circumambulations, followed by the entire pilgrim body. It was a strange homecoming. The emigrants must have felt highly emotional about their return, and yet, although the city was a ghost town, they were not free to do as they pleased. It had been settled at Hudaybiyah that this year the Muslims could only make the lesser pilgrimage, the Umrah, which did not include a visit to Mount Arafat and the Valley of Mina. In temporary exile from their city, the Quraysh had to watch, no doubt appalled, as Bilal, a former slave, climbed onto the roof of the Kaaba and summoned the Muslims to prayer. Three times a day his huge voice reverberated through the valley, urging all within earshot to come to prayer with the cry, "Allahu Akbar," reminding them that Allah was greater than all the idols in the haram, who could do nothing to prevent this ritual humiliation. It was an immense triumph for Muhammad, and many of the younger Quraysh became even more convinced that the old religion was doomed. Last evening in the city, Muhammad enjoyed another family reunion when his uncle Abbas, who still adhered to the old religion, was allowed to enter the city to visit his nephew and offer him the hand of his sister, Maimuna, who had recently been widowed. Muhammad accepted, doubtless hoping to entice Abbas himself into Islam and mischievously sent word to the Quraysh to invite them to the wedding. This was pushing things too far, and Suhail came down to inform Muhammad that his 3 days were up and he should leave immediately. Sa'd ibn Ubadah, a chief of Khazraj who was with the Prophet at the time, was furious at this apparent discourtesy, but Muhammad quickly silenced him. O Sa'd, no ill words to those who have come to visit us in our camp. To the astonishment of the Quraysh, the entire pilgrim throng left the city that night in good order. There were no loud protests, no attempt to repossess their old homes. In their peaceful withdrawal, the Muslims showed the confidence of those who expected a speedy return. The story of this strange pilgrimage spread rapidly, and more of the Bedouin came to Medina to become Muhammad's confederates. Of even greater significance was the steady stream of the younger generation of the Quraysh who converted to Islam. At Hudaybiyah, Muhammad had promised to return new converts to Mecca, but he had been able to find a loophole that enabled him to overcome this condition on a technicality. First, the treaty had said nothing about the handing back of women converts, so shortly after Hudaybiyah, Muhammad had received Uthman's half-sister into the Ummah and allowed her to remain. He did, however, return Abu Basir, an impetuous young man, and dispatched him to Mecca with a Quraishian envoy. But during the journey, Abu Basir killed his escort, and when Muhammad sent him away again, set up camp on the Red Sea coast near the trade route, where he was joined by 70 other young Meccan malcontents. These would-be Muslims became highwaymen, attacking every single Meccan caravan that came within their range, and the Quraysh discovered that the economic blockade had been partially reinstated. Eventually, they were forced to beg Muhammad to admit the young men into Medina and to make them abide by the treaty. So the ban on accepting converts became a dead letter, and in 629, a steady stream of new Muslims arrived in Medina. They included the young warriors Amr ibn al-As and Khalid ibn al-Walid, who had been convinced by Muhammad's success. "The way has become clear," Khalid said. "The man is certainly a prophet." He was afraid of reprisals, since he and Amra had both killed many Muslims at the battles of Uhud and the Trench. But Muhammad assured them that the act of Islam wiped out old debts and represented an entirely new start. In this year of political triumph, Muhammad had a private joy. None of the women he had married in Medina had borne him any children. But the governor of Alexandria in Egypt had sent him a beautiful curly-haired slave girl as a gift. Mariam was a Christian and did not wish to convert to Islam, but she became Muhammad's saraya, a wife who retained the status of a slave, Muhammad but whose children would be free, and was overjoyed when, at the end of 629, she became pregnant. He named their son Ibrahim and loved carrying him around Medina, inviting all passers-by to praise the baby's beautiful complexion and his likeness to himself. However, sorrow came along with joy. Muhammad's daughter Zainab had died shortly after he made the lesser pilgrimage, and later that year he lost 2 members of his family in a disastrous expedition to the Syrian border. We know very little about this ill-fated campaign. Muhammad may have wanted to bring the Christian Arab tribes there into the Ummah as confederates, on the same basis as the Jewish tribes of Khaybar. At all events, he dispatched Zayd and his cousin Ja'far to the north at the head of an army of 3,000 men. At the village of Muta, near the Dead Sea, the Muslims were attacked by a detachment of Byzantines. Zayd, Ja'far, and 10 other Muslims were killed, and Khalid, who had also accompanied the expedition, decided to bring the troops home. When Muhammad heard the news, he went directly to Ja'far's house, distraught to think that he had brought his dear cousin home to his death. Asma, Jafar's wife, was baking bread, and as soon as she saw the expression on Muhammad's face, she knew that something terrible had happened. Muhammad asked to see their two sons, knelt down beside the little boys, hugged them close, and wept. Immediately, Asma began to lament in the traditional Arab way. The women hurried to her, and Muhammad asked them to make sure to bring the family food during the next few days. As he walked through the streets to the mosque, Zaid's little girl ran out of their house and threw herself into his arms. Muhammad picked her up and stood there in the street, rocking her and weeping convulsively. The defeat at Muta had further jeopardized Muhammad's position in Medina. When Khalid brought the army home, he and his men were booed and hissed, and Muhammad had to take Khalid under his personal protection. But in November 629, the situation in Arabia changed dramatically. The Quraysh broke the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. Aided and abetted by some of the Quraysh, the tribe of Baqa, one of their Bedouin allies, made a surprise attack on the tribe of Khuza'a, which had joined Muhammad's confederacy. Khuza'a promptly asked Muhammad for help, and the Quraysh woke up to the fact that they had given Muhammad a perfect excuse to attack Mecca. Safwan and Ikrimah remained defiant, but Suhail was beginning to have second thoughts. Abu Sufyan, however, went further and arrived in Medina on a peace initiative. At this point, Abu Sufyan had no desire to convert to Islam, but he had realized for some time that the tide had turned in favor of Muhammad and that the Quraysh must try to get the best deal they could. In Medina, he visited his daughter Habiba and sat in conference with some of Muhammad's closest companions, trying to find a way of distancing himself from the dispute. Then he returned to Mecca, where he tried to prepare his fellow tribesmen to accept the inevitable. After his departure, Muhammad began to plan a new campaign.
On the 10th of Ramadan,
January 630, Muhammad set out at the head of the largest force ever to leave Medina. Nearly all the men in the Ummah had volunteered, and along the road their Bedouin allies joined forces with the Muslims, bringing the numbers up to 10,000 men. For security reasons, the destination of the expedition remained secret, but there was naturally a good deal of excited speculation. Certainly Mecca was a possibility, but Muhammad could just as easily have been heading for Taif, which was still implacably hostile to Islam. So the southern tribe of Hawazin started to assemble a massive army there. In Mecca, the Quraysh leaders feared the worst. Abbas, Abu Sufyan and Budail, chief of Khuza'a, all made their way under cover of night to the Muslim camp. There, Muhammad received them and asked Abu Sufyan if he was ready to accept Islam. Abu Sufyan replied that even though he now believed that Allah was the only God, the idols had proved to be useless, he still had doubts about Muhammad's prophethood. But he was shocked and impressed when he watched all the members of the massive army prostrating themselves in the direction of Mecca during the morning prayer. And when he saw the various tribes marching past on their way to the city, he knew that the Quraysh must surrender. He hurried back to Mecca and summoned the people by crying at the top of his voice, "O Quraysh, this is Muhammad, who has come to you with a force you cannot resist." He then offered them an option that had been suggested to him by Ali during his visit to Medina. Anybody who wanted to surrender should put himself under his personal protection. Muhammad had agreed to honour this. They should either take sanctuary in his home or remain in their own houses. Hind, his wife, was beside herself with rage. Seizing him by his moustaches, she yelled to the townspeople, "Kill this fat, greasy bladder of lard! What a rotten protector of his people!" But Abu Sufyan begged them not to listen. he described what he had seen in the Muslim camp. The time for such defiance was over. His grim sobriety impressed most of the Quraysh. Pragmatic to the last, they barricaded themselves into their houses as a token of surrender. A few wanted to fight, however. Ikrimah, Safwan and Suhail gathered a small force and tried to attack Khalid's section of the army as it approached the city, but they were quickly beaten. Safwan and Ikrimah fled, thinking their lives were at stake. Suhail laid down his arms and retired to his home. The rest of the Muslim army entered Mecca without striking a single blow. Muhammad had his red tent pitched near the Kaaba, and there he joined Salama and Maimuna, the two Qurayshi wives who had accompanied him, together with Ali and Fatima. Shortly after they had settled, Ali's sister, Hanni, arrived to plead for the lives of two of her relatives who had taken part in the fighting. Even though Ali and Fatima wanted them executed, Muhammad immediately promised that they would be safe. He had no desire for bloody reprisals. Nobody was made to accept Islam, nor do they seem to have felt any pressure to do so. Reconciliation was still Muhammad's objective.
After he had slept for a while, he rose and performed the morning prayer.
Then, mounted on Qaswa, he rode round the Kaaba 7 times, crying, "Allahu Akbar." The shout was taken up by the troops, and soon the words rang through the entire city, signalling the final victory of Islam. Next, Muhammad turned his attention to the idols of the Haram. Crowded onto their roofs and balconies, the Quraysh watched him smash each stone effigy while he recited the verse, "The truth has come and falsehood has vanished away. Surely falsehood is certain to vanish." Inside the Kaaba, the walls had been decorated with pictures of the pagan deities, and Muhammad ordered them all to be obliterated, though, it is said, he allowed frescoes of Jesus and Mary to remain. By this time, some of the Quraysh had ventured forth from their houses and made their way to the Kaaba, waiting for Muhammad to leave the shrine. He stood in front of the house of Allah and begged them to lay aside the arrogance and self-sufficiency of Jahiliyyah, which had created only conflict and injustice. "O Quraysh," he cried, "behold, God has removed from you the arrogance of Jahiliyyah with its boast of ancestral glories. Man is simply a God-conscious believer or an unfortunate sinner. All people are children of Adam, and Adam was created out of dust." Finally, Muhammad quoted the words that God had spoken in the Quran to the whole of humanity. "Behold, we have created you all out of a male or a female, and have made you into tribes and nations, so that you may come to know one another. Verily, the noblest of you in the sight of God is the one who is most deeply conscious of him. Behold, God is all-knowing, all-aware." The true hero was no longer an aggressive chauvinist, but was filled with reverent fear. The purpose of the tribe and the nation was no longer to exalt its superiority. They must not seek to dominate, exploit, convert, conquer, or destroy other peoples, but get to know them. The experience of living in a group, coexisting with people, some of whom, despite their kinship, would inevitably be uncongenial, should prepare the tribesman or the patriot for encounter with foreigners. It should lead to an appreciation of the unity of the human race. Muhammad had managed to redefine the concept of nobility in Arabia, replacing it with a more universal, compassionate, and self-effacing ideal. But were the Quraysh ready for this? Muhammad issued a general amnesty. Only about 10 people were put on the blacklist. They included Ikrimah, but not Safwan for some reason, and those who had spread anti-Muslim propaganda or injured the Prophet's family. Some of these miscreants asked for pardon, however, and they seem to have been spared. After his speech beside the Kaaba, Muhammad withdrew to Mount Safa and invited the people of Mecca to swear fealty. One by one, the Quraysh filed up to Muhammad, who sat, flanked
one
by
of the
Umar
women who
and
came
Abu Bakr.
Before him was Hind, Abu Sufyan's wife, who was on the blacklist for her mutilation of Hamza's body after the Battle of Uhud.
She remained defiant. "Forgive me what is past," she said, with no hint of apology, "and God will forgive you." Muhammad asked her if she would undertake not to commit adultery, theft, or infanticide. Would she promise not to kill her children? To this Hind replied, "I brought them up when they were little, but you killed them on the day of Badr when they were grown up." Muhammad tacitly conceded the point. Hind decided to convert to Islam, telling Muhammad that he could not continue to proceed against her now that she was a professing Muslim. The Prophet smiled and told her that, of course, she was free. Soon, Hind would see her husband and sons given important office in the Ummah as a reward for Abu Sufyan's cooperation. Relatives of Safwan and Ikrimah begged for their lives. Muhammad promised that if they accepted his leadership, they were free to enter Mecca. Both decided to return, and Ikrimah was the first to accept Islam. Muhammad greeted him affectionately and forbade anybody to vilify his father, Abu Jahil. Safwan and Suhail both swore fealty to Muhammad, but could not yet make the Muslim profession of faith, though they changed their minds a few days later. Once Muhammad had secured the city, he had to deal with the tribes of Hawazin and Thaqif, who had mustered an army of 20,000 men at nearby Ta'if. Muhammad managed to defeat them at the Battle of Hunain at the end of January 630, and the Hawazin joined Muhammad's confederacy. The Muslims were not able to take Ta'if itself, but the city became so isolated through the loss of its chief Bedouin ally that it was forced to capitulate a year later. When he divided the booty after his victory at Hunain, Muhammad gave Abu Sufyan, Suhail, and Safwan the lion's share. Safwan was so overcome that he instantly made his surrender. "I bear witness that no soul could have such goodness as this if it were not the soul of the Prophet," he cried. "I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and that you are his messenger." Suhail followed his example. Some of the helpers were offended by this apparent favouritism. Did it mean that Muhammad would abandon them now that he had been reunited with his own tribe? Muhammad instantly reassured them by making a moving speech which reduced many of them to tears. He would never forget their generosity to him while he was a mere refugee, and promised that far from settling in Mecca, he would make Medina his home for the rest of his life. "Are you not satisfied that other men should take away flocks and herds, while you take back with you the apostle of God?" he asked. "If all men went one way and the helpers another, I should take the way of the helpers. God have mercy on the helpers, their sons and their sons' sons." It was a strange conquest, and an impartial observer might have wondered why the Muslims and the Quraysh had fought at all. Muhammad kept his word and returned to Medina with the emigrants and helpers. He did not attempt to rule Mecca himself, nor did he replace the Quraysh officials with his own companions, nor did he establish a purist Islamic regime. All former dignitaries kept their positions in the Haram and the Assembly, and the status quo remained intact. His most hated enemies were not only reinstated, but promoted
when
and
Muhammad
showered with gifts.
Was about
to reassign the most prestigious function of the Haram, that of providing water to the pilgrims, to the notable who had just given him the keys of the Kaaba, Muhammad asked him, "You can surely see, now that this key is in my hand, that I can assign it to whomever I want." The notable, thinking that the office would now go to one of the Muslims, cried in anguish, "Then the glory and might of Quraysh is gone." Muhammad promptly replied, as he handed back the key, "To the contrary, today it is entrenched and glorious." Muhammad's work was almost done. After his return home, the opposition in Ibn Ubay's camp continued. There was yet another plot to assassinate Muhammad, who tried to woo his enemies by dispatching more lucrative expeditions to the north. In October 631, he became aware that a mosque in Medina had become a centre of disaffection, so he was forced to destroy it. The following morning, he held an inquiry into the conduct of the people who had been plotting against him. They hastily apologised. Most offered plausible excuses and were pardoned, though three were formally shunned by the Ummah for nearly 2 months. This seems to have finished the Muslim opposition. Not long after this capitulation, Ibn Ubay died, and Muhammad stood beside the grave of his old adversary as a mark of respect. He had finally managed to create a viable united society in Medina, and more of the Bedouin were prepared to accept his political supremacy, even though they were not committed to his religious vision. In 10 short years since the Hijra, Muhammad had irrevocably changed the political and spiritual landscape of Arabia. However, he was visibly failing, and by the beginning of 632, increasingly conscious that he was approaching the end of his life. He was immensely distressed when his baby son Ibrahim died, and he wept bitterly, though he was certain that he would soon be with him in paradise. But when the traditional month for the Hajj approached, he announced that he would lead the pilgrimage and set out at the end of February with all his wives and a huge crowd of pilgrims, arriving outside Mecca in early March. He led the Muslims through the rituals that were so dear to the hearts of the Arabs, giving them a new significance. Instead of being reunited with their tribal deities, the Muslims were to gather round the house, the Kaaba, built by their ancestors, Abraham and Ishmael. When they ran 7 times between Safa and Marwa, Muhammad instructed the pilgrims to remember the distress of Hagar, Ishmael's mother, when, after Abraham had abandoned them in the wilderness, she had run frantically to and fro in search of water for her baby. God had saved them by causing the spring of Zamzam to well up from the depths of the earth. Next, the pilgrims recalled their unity with the rest of humanity when they made a standing vigil on the slopes of Mount Arafat, where, it was said, God had made a covenant with Adam, the father of the entire human race. At Mina, they threw stones at the three pillars as a reminder of the constant struggle, the jihad with temptation, that a godly life required. Finally, they sacrificed a sheep, in memory of the sheep Abraham sacrificed after he had offered his own son to God. The mosque of Namira stands near Mount Arafat, on the spot where Muhammad preached his farewell sermon to the Muslim community. He reminded them to deal justly with one another, to treat women kindly, and to abandon the blood feuds and vendettas inspired by the spirit of Jahiliyyah. Muslim must never fight against Muslim. Know that every Muslim is a Muslim's brother, and that the Muslims are brethren. It is only lawful to take from a brother what he gives you willingly, so wrong not yourselves, Muhammad concluded. O God, have I not told you? There was pathos in this last appeal. Muhammad knew that despite his repeated admonitions, not all Muslims fully understood his vision. Standing before them for what he knew would probably be the last time, he may have wondered whether all his efforts had been in vain. "O people," he cried suddenly, "have I faithfully delivered my message to you?" There was a powerful murmur of assent from the assembled crowd. "O God, yes. Allahumma na'am." In a touchingly human plea for reassurance, Muhammad asked the same question again and again, and each time the words "Allahumma na'am" rumbled through the valley like thunder. Muhammad raised his forefinger to the heavens and said, "O Allah, bear witness." When he returned to Medina, Muhammad began to experience incapacitating headaches and fainting attacks, but he never retired permanently to bed. He would often wrap a cloth round his aching temples and go to the mosque to lead the prayers or to address the people. One morning, he seemed to pray for an especially long time in honour of the Muslims who had died at Uhud, and added, "God has given one of his servants the choice between this world and that which is with God, and he has chosen the latter." The only person who seems to have understood this reference to his imminent death was Abu Bakr, who began to weep bitterly. "Gently, gently, Abu Bakr," Muhammad said tenderly. Eventually, Muhammad collapsed in the apartment of Maimuna. His wives hung lovingly over him and noticed that he kept asking, "Where shall I be tomorrow? Where shall I be tomorrow?" And they realized that he wanted to know when he could be with Aisha. They agreed that he should be moved to her hut and nursed there. Muhammad lay quietly with his head in Aisha's lap. But people seemed to have believed that he was merely suffering from a temporary indisposition. Even though Abu Bakr repeatedly warned them that the Prophet was not long for this world, the community was in denial. When he became too ill to go to the mosque, he asked Abu Bakr to lead the prayers for him, but still he would sometimes attend the prayer, sitting quietly beside Abu Bakr, even though he was too weak to recite the words himself.
On the 12th of Rabi,
June the 8th, 632, Abu Bakr noticed during prayers that the people were distracted and knew at once that Muhammad must have entered the mosque. He looked much better. Indeed, somebody said that they had never seen him so radiant, and a wave of joy and relief swept through the congregation. Abu Bakr instantly made ready to stand down, but Muhammad put his hands on his shoulders, pushed him gently back to the head of the community, and sat down next to him until the service was over. Afterwards, he went back to Aisha's hut and lay peacefully in her lap. He seemed so much improved that Abu Bakr asked leave to visit his wife, who lived on the other side of Medina. During the afternoon, Ali and Abbas both looked in and spread the good news that Muhammad was on the mend. As evening approached, Aisha felt him leaning more heavily against her than before, and he seemed to be losing consciousness. Still, she did not realize what was happening. As she said later, "It was due to my ignorance and extreme youth that the Prophet died in my arms." She heard him murmur the words, "Nay, the most exalted companion in paradise." Gabriel had come to fetch him. Looking down, Aisha discovered that he had gone. Carefully, she laid his head on the pillow and began to beat her breast, slap her face, and cry aloud in the traditional way. When the people heard the women lamenting the dead, they hurried, ashen-faced, to the mosque. The news travelled quickly through the oasis, and Abu Bakr hurried back to the city. He took one look at Muhammad, kissed his face, and bade him farewell. In the mosque, he found Omar addressing the crowds. Omar absolutely refused to believe that the Prophet was dead. His soul had just left his body temporarily, he argued, and he would certainly return to his people. He would be the last of them all to die. The hysteria in Omar's compulsive harangue must have been evident, because Abu Bakr murmured, "Gently, Omar." But Omar simply could not stop talking. All that Abu Bakr could do was step forward quietly, and his composure must have impressed the people because they gradually stopped listening to Omar's tirade and clustered around him. Abu Bakr reminded them that Muhammad had dedicated his entire life to the preaching of Tawheed, the unity of God. How could they possibly imagine that he was immortal? That would be tantamount to saying that he was divine, a second god. Constantly, Muhammad had warned them against honouring him in the same way as Christians venerated Jesus. He was a mere mortal, no different from anybody else. To refuse to admit that Muhammad had died was, therefore, to deny his message. But as long as Muslims remained true to the belief that God alone was worthy of worship, Muhammad would live on in their minds. "O people, if anyone worships Muhammad, Muhammad is dead," he ended firmly. "If anyone worships God, God is alive, immortal." Finally, he recited the verse that had been revealed to Muhammad after the Battle of Uhud, when many of the Muslims had been shocked by the false rumour of his death. "Muhammad is naught but a messenger. Messengers have passed away before him. Why, if he should die or is slain, will you turn upon your heels? If any man should turn about upon his heels, he will not harm God in any way, and God will recompense the thankful." The verses made such an impact on the people that it was as though they were hearing them for the first time. Omar was completely overcome. "By God, when I heard Abu Bakr recite those words, I was dumbfounded, so that my legs would not bear me, and I fell to the ground," knowing that the apostle was indeed
Muhammad
dead.
Had been as controversial in his dying as in his living.
Very few of his followers had comprehended the full significance of his prophetic career. These fissures within the community had surfaced at Hudaybiyah, when most of the pilgrims seemed to have expected something miraculous to occur. People came to Islam for very different reasons. Many were devoted to the ideal of social justice, but not to Muhammad's ideal of non-violence and reconciliation. The rebellious young highwayman who followed Abu Basir had an entirely different agenda from the Prophet. The Bedouin tribesmen, who had not volunteered for the pilgrimage in 628, had a political rather than a religious commitment to Islam. From the very beginning, Islam was never a monolithic entity. There is nothing surprising about this lack of unity. In the Gospels, Jesus' disciples are often presented as obtuse and blind to the deeper aspect of his mission. Paradigmatic figures are usually so far ahead of their time that their contemporaries fail to understand them, and, after their deaths, the movement splinters, as Buddhism divided into Hinayana and Mahayana schools not long after the death of Siddhartha Gautama. In Islam, too, the divisions that had split the Ummah during the Prophet's lifetime became even clearer after his death. Many of the Bedouin, who had never fully comprehended the religious message of the Quran, believed that Islam had died with Muhammad and felt free to secede from the Ummah in the same way as they would renege on any treaty with a deceased chieftain. After the Prophet's death, the community was led by his Khalifa, his successor. The first four caliphs were elected by the people: Abu Bakr, Omar, Uthman and Ali, known as the Rightly Guided or Rashidun caliphs. They led wars of conquest outside Arabia, but at the time these had no religious significance. Like any statesmen or generals, the Rashidun were responding to a political opportunity, the disintegration of the Persian and Byzantine empires, rather than a Quranic imperative. the terrible civil wars that resulted in the assassinations of Umar, Uthman, Ali, and Hussein, the Prophet's grandson, were later given a religious significance, but at the time were simply a byproduct of an extraordinarily accelerated transition from a peripheral, primitive polity to the status of a major world power. Far more surprising than this political turbulence was the Muslims' response. Their understanding of the Quran matured when they considered these disastrous events. Nearly every single major religious and literary development in Islam has had its origin in a desire to return to the original vision of the Prophet. Many were appalled by the lavish lifestyle of later caliphs and tried to return to the austere vision of the early Ummah. Mystics, theologians, historians, and jurists asked important questions. How could a society that killed its devout leaders claim to be guided by God? What kind of man should lead the Ummah? Could rulers who lived in such luxury and condoned the poverty of the vast majority of the people be true Muslims? Debates about the political leadership of the Ummah played a role in Islam that was similar to the great Christological debates of the 4th and 5th centuries in Christianity. The ascetic spirituality of Sufism had its roots in this discontent. Sufis turned their back on the luxury of the court and tried to live as austerely as the Prophet. They developed a mysticism modelled on his night journey and ascension to heaven. The Shia, the self-styled party of Ali, Muhammad's closest male relative, believed that the Ummah must be led by one of Ali's direct descendants, since they alone had inherited the Prophet's charisma. Shi'is developed a piety of protest against the injustice of mainstream Muslim society and tried to return to the egalitarian spirit of the Quran. Yet while these and many other movements looked back to the towering figure of Muhammad, they all took the Quranic vision into entirely new directions and showed that the original revelations had the flexibility to respond to unprecedented circumstances that is essential to any great world movement. From the very start, Muslims used their prophet as a yardstick by which to challenge their politicians and to measure the spiritual health of the Ummah. This critical spirit is needed today. Some Muslim thinkers regard the jihad against Mecca as the climax of Muhammad's career and fail to note that he eventually abjured warfare and adopted a non-violent policy. Western critics also persist in viewing the Prophet of Islam as a man of war and fail to see that from the very first he was opposed to the Jahili arrogance and egotism that not only fueled the aggression of his time, but is much in evidence in some leaders, Western and Muslim alike, today. The Prophet, whose aim was peace and practical compassion, is becoming a symbol of division and strife, a development that is not only tragic, but also dangerous to the stability on which the future of our species depends. At the end of my first attempt to write a biography of Muhammad, I quoted the prescient words of the Canadian scholar Wilfred Cantwell Smith. Writing in the mid-20th century, shortly before the Suez Crisis, he observed that a healthy, functioning Islam had for centuries helped Muslims cultivate decent values, which we in the West share, because they spring from a common tradition. Some Muslims have problems with Western modernity. They have turned against the cultures of the people of the book and have even begun to Islamize their new hatred of these sister faiths, which were so powerfully endorsed by the Quran. Cantwell Smith argued that if they are to meet the challenge of the day, Muslims must learn to understand our Western traditions and institutions because they are not going to disappear. If Islamic societies did not do this, he maintained, they would fail the test of the 20th century. But, he pointed out that Western people also have a problem, an inability to recognise that they share the planet not with inferiors, but with equals. Unless, Cantwell Smith concluded, Western civilization intellectually and socially, politically and economically, and the Christian Church theologically, can learn to treat other men with fundamental respect, these two, in their turn, will have failed to come to terms with the actualities of the 20th century. The problems raised in this are, of course, as profound as anything that we have touched on for Islam. The brief history of the 21st century shows that neither side has mastered these lessons. If we are to avoid catastrophe, the Muslim and Western worlds must learn not merely to tolerate, but to appreciate one another. A good place to start is with the figure of Muhammad, a complex man who resists facile, ideologically driven categorization, who sometimes did things that were difficult or impossible for us to accept, but who had profound genius and founded a religion and cultural tradition that was based not on the sword, but whose name, Islam, signified peace and reconciliation.
The end. You've been listening to Muhammad, A Prophet for Our Time, by Karen Armstrong, narrated by the author. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Bookseller of Kabul by Osna Seierstadt, in a translation by Ingrid Christofferson, narrated by Joanna David. Award-winning journalist Osna Seierstadt was invited to live with Sultan Khan, a bookseller in Kabul. This account of her experience has Khan and his family speak for themselves, giving us a genuinely gripping and moving portrait of their life and of a country replete with great cultural riches and extreme contradictions. But this is also a rare look at contemporary life under Islam, where even after the Taliban's collapse, women must submit to arranged marriages, polygamous husbands, and crippling limitations on their ability to travel, learn, and communicate with others. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to www.recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.